This Week in Radio Tech, episode 226, is brought to you by the Telos Zip 1 Automatic IP Audio Codec. Easy to use and it's automatic. By Lavvo, maker of the new Crystal Clear Virtual Radio Console. Intuitive, progressive, and focused. Crystal Clear is the radio console with a multi-touch touchscreen interface. And by the Axia Radius IP Audio Console. It's affordable, it's beautiful, it's powerful. And only Axia connects to so much so easily. Hey, some engineers get their careers started in smaller markets, then move up to a major market. Well, David Antoine was born and raised in U.S. market number one, New York City. So that's where he started. David's story is both interesting and inspiring. So we're bringing him to you on this episode of TWRC. Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host. So glad you're here. This is the show where we talk about everything that has to do with radio and audio technology. Typically in a radio station from this microphone, you know, where people talk into, all the way to the beacon at the top of the tower and everything in between. I'm at a radio station right now. Kirk, where are you? I'm in your computer. I'm on your phone, your tablet. I'm at a very temporary setup here. I hope this is temporary. This doesn't become one of those. We'll clean it up eventually. I'm in a room here where we're running a bunch of Rivendell computers, running at the moment three radio stations, and by later today we'll be running four radio stations at Delta Radio here in Greenville, Mississippi. Along with us today is Chris Tobin, and he is in a laboratory in an unnamed location. Hey, Chris, welcome in. How you doing?
I'm doing well, Kirk. Thank you. Yeah, this is actually my office space, lab, whatever you want to call it. Thought I'd try something from here for today.
Wait, you mean all these times you've been on the show, and this is the first time that I've seen this lab?
Yes, because actually the last several times that I had an opportunity to try and do it from the office, I had some guys working on things, and it was just a mess. And visually, it didn't translate. Audibly, it would have been an enjoyable time, but the video and the audio just didn't match up, so it wouldn't have worked.
Man, I hope I can come up there and see that next time I come to New York.
You're always welcome. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, David Antoine invited me to stop up at his new employer in Purchase, New York, at that new, what used to be ABC Satellite Services. Cumulus got it and moved it out to Purchase, New York, and built a whole big facility there. You want to see if we can go out there together?
Sure. Yeah, Brian Wilson, I had lunch with him over the weekend, and he and Greg Monty and a few others from Cumulus Media said, come on up. So if you're making it to town, let me know. I'll go for the ride. Yeah, definitely.
I'm thinking right before the SBE national meeting and you know at Verona, I'll be there. You know, a day or two before that.
What date is that?
That'd be early in October.
October, okay.
Like around the 6th or something like that.
Perfect. Okay.
Yeah. Well, we'll call see if we can arrange it. Okay. Sorry. Enough inside baseball talk, folks. Hey, our show is brought to you by the folks at Axia. The Axia Radius console, also brought to you by Telos and the Telos HX6 phone system. And our show is brought to you by Lavvo, makers of the incredible Crystal Clear touchscreen virtual radio console. We'll tell you about each of those things here. Actually, we'll start out with the Axia Radius console. This is pretty cool. There's one of them, actually this show right now, is coming to you. The audio is coming to you through an Axia Radius IP audio console. And there it is. That is at the GFQ network in New York. And that's handling all the audio, including all the mix minus feeds. That's how the various talent that are coming in by Skype are hearing themselves and hearing the other people, but not hearing their own echo coming back. Like all of the consoles that Axia makes, the Radius can produce an automatic mix minus for every single fader input. If it's got a return channel, then the Radius will make a mix minus channel for it. That's the 8-channel version of the Radius console. And what you're looking at is really just the control surface. There's no audio going through that piece of equipment. All the audio is really conveniently located in the equipment rack. There's a DSP engine in the equipment rack. It has a built-in Ethernet switch, so you don't have to buy an external Cisco or HP switch. You can just use the pre-configured switch that's inside the Axia Radius console. And some of the ports on that switch have PoE, power over Ethernet. So that means if you get a Telos phone system to go along with your Radius console, well, you just plug the phones in. No power adapters needed, no boxes like that, no PoE switch needed, because it's built in to the back of the Axia Radius console. I personally have three of these consoles at my stations in American Samoa. And believe me, that is a long way to travel to go do some troubleshooting. We haven't had to. They've just been flawless. So I want you to check them out on the web. If you go to axiaaudio.com, click on the products page, and right there is a page just for the Radius console. Also should point out, these consoles may cost a lot less than you might think. I had a friend of the show contact me on Facebook a few days ago and said, Kirk, we'd love to do these IP consoles, but man, we don't have, you know, $15,000 for what an Axia Element might cost. I said, get ready to pay a whole lot less than half of that, because that's what you'll end up paying for an Axia Radius console. I think it's still around the $6,000 mark for an IP audio console. And easy to expand. You can add a 6 or 8 fader expansion module to that, a phone interface or a phone controller module to control your Telos phone system. So give it a check out on the web, axiaaudio.com, represented all over the world in most countries, and represented in the U.S. by Broadcasters General Store. All right, thanks to Axia for sponsoring this week in Radio Tech. Now, hey, Chris, Tobin, we're going to talk to a good friend of yours, David Antoine. He spoke highly of you. You two know each other, don't you?
Yes, we've worked together. I helped build his new facilities, well, his previous facilities, at 4 Times Square for the public radio station he worked at. So, I mean, he and I worked together with other engineering firms around the metro area for the last, I don't know, 15, 20 years.
Well, I got a chance to talk to him. And by the way, thank you for the tips on what to ask him. We did talk mostly about how he got started. I mean, you know, growing up in Brooklyn, how do you end up getting involved with how do you work toward being a broadcast engineer? What avenues do you travel to get that done? Which subway stops do you get on and get off to increase your chances of getting a career like this? And so Dave is just a dear guy. And Andrew, if you're ready, why don't we just go ahead and roll that interview, and we'll follow up with a couple comments and questions right after it. Andrew, take it away. Hey, it's Kirk Harnack. I'm talking to David Antoine. Now, hey, David, welcome in. Glad you're here on the show.
Oh, glad to be here.
David, you and I met, I don't know, it must have been some social event or something. I just remember chatting with you, and it seems like my wife was chatting with you for the longest time about our kids and going to
guys,
school.
You guys came to New York, and I led a tour during it was N's workshop that was in New York City. Yeah. And I led a tour with you, your wife, David Lair, and a couple other folks to the Empire State Building.
Ah, okay. Okay. Yeah. That was it.
Yes.
That
was it. Yes, yes, yes. That's when it was. That was some years ago.
Hey, yeah, it was a few years ago. But that reminds me, I've got a picture of me and my wife, Laura, on top of the Empire State Building, you know, in the caged in area.
Yes.
There with all the,
yep,
you know, where the commoners get to go and look over the edge.
Yep.
Or close. Wow, so that has been a few years. Did and you had a daughter who went to school in Nashville.
That's right. That's
yeah,
right.
Cool.
Went to Vanderbilt.
Cool. Well, we didn't come to talk about that. We're here to talk about radio tech, because that's, mm-hmm, that's what geeks like us do.
Right.
So you're a broadcast engineer, and by all accounts, a pretty good one. Tell me a little bit about your career in broadcast engineering, and we'll finish up with what you're doing now.
Broadcast engineering, it was something that I guess I kind of always wanted to do, but took an interesting route to get there. I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, Bedford-Stuyvesant, for those of you that need to know what that means, Bed-Stuy, as we call it. But born and raised in Brooklyn, grew up in Bed-Stuy. In my early mid-teens, I hooked up with a guy who was a mobile DJ. And for those of you that don't know, a mobile DJ at the time meant this was a guy who walked around with his own system, a milk crate or two full of records, a couple of turntables, and promoters would hire them for dances. And at the time, there were no discos or dance halls or places like that. They were just like these places people would rent out, you know, and have their little affairs at. So we'd come in, set up speakers and lights and everything, and it was a party. Well, at some point, we decided that we would add microphones to the mix. And I started doing live sound. And it got to a point where me and my partner, a brother named QJ, we would be doing live shows where the promoter would hire a band and we would play, spin music in between the sets that the band would play. And we started getting a reputation for doing good sound engineering. People started like saying, boy, you know, the musicians were like, boy, you guys did a real good job, you know, like to use you again. So we started working with more promoters here in the New York City area, doing concerts and clubs and shows and things like that. And at some point in the mix, I decided that I wanted to get into broadcasting. And I said, all right, doing live sound is nice, but I need to pay rent regularly. You know, you work with a band for 6 months, you tour, and then they take off for 6 months, and you got to figure the rest out. So got tired of doing that at some point, and I said, all right.
But I want to interrupt for a second. I got to believe that doing live sound, especially if you had somebody who knew what they were doing to help you learn the ropes at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
I've been to so many events where the live sound was just awful. Just, yep. Oh, distorted, way too much highs. You just,
yep.
Oh, you impinge upon your ears.
Yep.
And so if you get tied with somebody, you learn, and what I'm getting at, you learn what good sound sounds like.
Absolutely.
And that's a skill that you just can't tell somebody about. You've got experience that for hours and hours and hours, and so you get to know what it's like. And some guys who got their career in broadcast engineering by working in a recording studio also get that skill.
Exactly.
So yes. I'm sorry to interrupt, but that's so critical. If you know what good sound sounds like and you want to achieve that, I think you can go anywhere in the audio business,
right,
including broadcast engineering.
Right, right. And that's part of it. And although it's interesting, I've never been a processing guru as some of my colleagues are. Uh-huh. But I do know what good sound is. And one of the things that is interesting is that my first job in radio was with a classical radio station. Uh-huh. And that was that was after having come off the road with working with bands like the Tramps and Brass Construction and working in disco nightclubs till 4 a.m. for many years. So I went to a school called ATS here in town, and they basically were what most people would call back then a license mill. The difference for me was that a lot of what they were teaching us out of the books made sense because of my audio background. So I kind of was now validating the things I already knew just from working. So the added factor was learning RF. And believe me when I say about easily 50% of what I learned back there in that school, I still use on the job, especially when I walk into a transmitter room. I learned how to walk out of there.
Yeah. So this school had some safety, you know.
Oh, they covered training? Everything. They covered safety. They covered RF. They covered FCC regs. They covered everything. It was very thorough.
So in your mind, to me, this is a little bit like when I was in my 20s, I learned how to fly a fixed-wing airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And I never had a chance to transition to a helicopter, you know, a rotary-wing airplane. But I always thought that transition must be a bit like transitioning from the live sound world into broadcast. Or broadcast when you've got to take on these, you know, oh, now there's RF too, you know. It's not just big speakers. In fact, we don't have big speakers and big amps and broadcast so much. The big amp is the transmitter.
Well, it's called RF because it's radio frequencies, and audio is just audio frequencies. It's all frequencies and waves and stuff. It's just that the RF waves are moving a lot faster than the sound waves.
Yes.
So
yes.
You just got to double up the principles, if you will.
You know, I like to think of this as The electronics are a lot the same. I mean, there's amplifiers and there's filters and there's high pass and low pass things and there's oscillators.
Yes.
You know, in a piano, your oscillator is the key hits your finger hits the key and the key strikes a string and that's the oscillator. In a broadcast transmitter, you've got different kinds of, now we have numerically controlled oscillators, but we used to have crystals and such.
Sure.
When you move from audio to RF, the shape of the circuits kind of changes, and some of the techniques change, but it's still taking a varying signal, whether it's digital on off on off on off or an analog signal or a frequency varying signal, and doing stuff with that.
Right, you're just speeding it up when it comes to broadcasting. Hence, you're doing things at a RF rate, if you will.
Oh, and then you think about the input and output devices. The transducers for audio are certainly different than the transducers for RF, but they're doing the same thing. They're converting, the signal into a usable form. RF, it's electromagnetic waves. Audio, it's sound air pressure vibrations.
Mm-hmm.
So okay, I don't mean to talk here. So how did you gain this RF information? How did you start to learn about that after you got out of ATS?
Well, kind of on the job training. Got out of ATS and. The last thing they did with us was they, job search techniques. They taught us, how to put together a resume, how to put together a cover letter that stands out. And they said, look, the mailbox is your friend. So I started sending out resumes. And for me, every time I got a rejection letter in the mail, I would send out 10 more resumes.
Yeah.
And finally, one day, I landed with a classical radio station here in town, which is now defunct, called WNCN, which was owned by GAF Broadcasting Company. And that's the same GAF that puts roofs on your buildings back in the day.
Okay.
All right. The story behind that is that WNCN was an established classical station back in the 50s and 60s. And a group came along and bought them and turned them into rock and roll. So the listeners group got together, picketed, boycotted, just made a fuss. And the chairman at the time of GAF Corporation was an avid classical listener. The group persuaded him to buy the station.
Hmm.
And hence GAF Broadcasting.
I love that.
And complete with the GAF logo and everything. I've got my old business card with a GAF logo on it.
is GAF out of the broadcasting business?
Totally
now?
Out, yeah.
Okay.
They were part of the whole Union Carbide thing over in India and Bhopal. Okay. So, yeah.
Well, I'll bet you as long as you worked there that the roof never leaked.
Absolutely. So that was my first job in radio, and that was back in 1981.
Okay. We started about the same time.
Wow. Okay. So, yeah, that was my first job in radio.
I thought you were a much younger man than me.
No. And I was fortunate to work under a chief engineer who didn't mind me asking him questions and didn't mind showing me the ropes. And what was good was that the school that I went to prepared me with a lot of book knowledge and practical knowledge follow.
And so you had the book knowledge, the concepts.
Yes.
So when you were shown the equipment and how things interacted and worked, it clicked at that point.
Absolutely. Okay. And let me tell you how much it clicked.
Okay.
When he took me to the Empire State Building and showed me my first live transmitter. It was an old Collins transmitter, okay? So it still had the grounding rod in it, which you don't find in today's solid-state transmitters.
Oh, yeah, some people call that a Jesus stick.
The Jesus stick, exactly.
Yeah.
So I remember vividly him saying, all right, whenever you work on a transmitter, you shut the power off and you take this rod and you touch everything. And I'm looking over his shoulder, and I'm like, really? He says, yeah, you just touch it. And he's just kind of haphazardly touching this, touching that, touching this. So at one point I asked him, I said, have you ever found any, residual voltages or anything? He says, nah, never. And the very next thing he touched, I guess was a capacitor, and all of a sudden, pow! And my eyes were wide, and I saw this chunk taken out of the stick, the grounding rod.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was a lesson to me. Use that stick.
So now I'm. Most transmitters are designed with some bleeder resistors. If it was a high voltage power supply cap, but those bleeder resistors fail, and you have no indication
that the resistors failed
unless it catches on fire until you touch the Jesus stick to it,
and bam!
You say, oh, guess what? Didn't bleed off.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is kind of unnerving when you have to work on today's solid state transmitters because they don't include a Jesus stick anymore.
Yeah.
And you know. Guys like myself who open up the back of a cabinet and look at a transmitter go, I don't know about this.
Yeah. Well, I guess the DC voltages in most solid-state transmitters, the voltages
are so low,
they're not lethal typically,
but the currents, yes.
Of course, they're built with very high current power supplies.
Yes.
Some of the early solid-state transmitters did use lethal in that they were, 150, 200 volts for the transistors. But I understand, I haven't worked on a modern solid-state transmitter personally in a few years, so I haven't worked on a modern one, a contemporary. Mm-hmm. But I understand they're down now around the 50-volt range on a lot of these.
In fact, I think the new Imagine transmitter –
mm-hmm.
Their power supplies are the same supplies you find in some servers.
Ah, okay.
So, you're talking about a server power supply powering a transmitter.
Well, there's some economy of scale right there.
Yeah. So,
So that was
my first job in broadcasting. I learned a lot there. I learned not how to survive a transmitter run by myself. Learned a lot about RF, about just what goes on in a studio. It was a good run. I worked there for 5 years, and then there were a lot of changes in the company, and I got let go. But down the road, I worked for paging companies and worked for some other stations in town. Eventually, getting back into radio for a minute, I was working at a paging company and just doing paging transmitters and servicing stuff like that. And those transmitters, believe it or not, were more dangerous than the high power transmitters that I was working on with FM radio, only because of the high frequencies. And those transmitters, you're talking about like 900, 800 megahertz transmitters that the only way to check certain things in them was to open up the cavity while it's hot and live. So it's not so much the voltage or the RF, but just the microwaves that you're being exposed to. But again, all leading up to me becoming a better engineer, and managed to work for some stations here in town, like Inner City Broadcasting's WBLS and their AM WLIB. Worked for Emmis for a while as a project engineer. Worked with DSI RF systems and built some transmitter rooms for a couple of stations and serviced some transmitter rooms in the Empire State Building. That's how I happened to lead the tour that I met you on some years back. Also worked with your colleague Tom Ray at WOR for a while. Doing some maintenance for him. So been around the New York market for a little while, and it's been good. It's been 34 years of having fun, being a radio.
What prompted me to think, I've got to get David Antoine on Twert and have a conversation with him. And you're pretty busy during the day these days, and that's why we were recording this interview beforehand for playback on our usual show. But you were interviewed by Radio World. And great picture of you, by the way. It looked like a very professional picture. Good work there.
Yes.
So what was that article about? What did you and Radio World focus on?
Well, Paul McLean, the editor, called me up, and we were just, catching up one day. And he said, by the way, I do this little profile thing, and, like to talk to you. Just let me shoot you some questions. So he did. And I wrote back answers to the questions. And basically, it was just some of the very things we're talking about here, how I got started in radio, where I, you know, where I came from, how it all came about. Couple of other questions that he did ask me about was my involvement in public radio. For the past 5.5 years, ending this past August, I worked for WBGO, which is one of the few remaining jazz stations here in the country. Mm. And they're based in Newark, New Jersey, 88.3 FM. And again, one of the remaining full-time jazz radio stations in the United States. So for 22 and a half hours a day, you can tune into BGO and hear live jazz being played. There's somebody in the studio right now as we speak putting a CD into a CD player and elaborating on who played on drums and who was on sax and when was the date recorded and such. And, you know, that was a lot of fun and enjoyment for me working in jazz and in public radio. Pretty much because I have a jazz background. I grew up, as I told you, I did live audio for a while, and my introduction to live audio was putting microphones in front of people like Max Roach, Betty Carter, Freddie Hubbard, Pharoah Saunders. Yeah. So as a teenager, I was at a cultural center in Brooklyn, and because they didn't serve alcohol and drinks, I was able to work there and learn sound and learn audio, and that's where I learned audio at.
Wow, that's cool. That's cool. Yeah, when I was 15, 16 years old, I was working in public radio, too. I was an intern at WEKU-FM, and I was playing jazz and just butchering the names of all the jazz artists, I'm sure. But learning a little bit about it, I mean, a little bit was rubbing off, and a love for jazz music, you know, was brought to me that way.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So, before we got started here recording, you mentioned that you want to talk a bit about public radio engineers.
Yes.
Tell me about the plight of the public radio engineer nowadays.
Well, you know, it's the term bricks without straw comes to mind. You know, public engineers oftentimes don't have the large budgets that our commercial counterparts do. You know, we find ourselves having to recycle a lot of equipment, recycle cables, and really make do most of the time to get our audio on the air and make it sound pristine. Mm-hmm. One of the things I've been blessed to be involved with is the Association of Public Radio Engineers, and I've been a member of their board of directors now for a couple of years now. And it's an organization that really just tries to serve the public radio engineer and their interests, which tend to be unique. A lot of us are managing stations that are NPR affiliates, so we do handle a lot of NPR programming. And, you know, there's challenges. I mean, a lot of these stations, some of them are only like 100 watts. They're considered to be low-power FM stations. And, you know, they find themselves at the lower end of the dial usually and not sometimes having the best coverage in town. And there's just a lot of challenges that we as public engineers have faced, you know, in attempting to do quality broadcasting. Now, some of my colleagues work for stations that are owned by colleges where there might be a large, you know, budget that is available, but that's not the case for a lot of others that are in rural parts of the country. Again, little 100-watt stations where sometimes the general manager is the chief engineer and the salesperson by day, you know. You know, I the time that I spent in public radio the past 5.5 years, I just developed an affinity for these guys and what they, you know, what they're able to do with what little that they have and the resources that they don't have. And
it's interesting. I see, just as in the commercial world, though, I see a diversity of funding for public radio stations. I mean, I've some of the nicest stations I've been into were public radio stations, and some of the poorest ones were public stations. And for some, it seems like feast or famine. Like they'll get a big grant,
right?
Or they'll get some money to do something specific: buy a transmitter, buy a studio, buy an audio console, or re-outfit a studio. But then, as you said, they got to recycle cables, you know, because the money ran out because the project was done. And there's not a budget to, you know, maintain at that level. So you got to scrimp and save and scrimp and save for years until the next grant or project comes along.
Yeah.
Do you find that to be true?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And in some cases, you find it's MacGyver radio, as my IT guy at WBGO used to say. You know, yes. you learn to make do. You know, you learn to improvise.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. Wow. Well, hey, so
he doesn't know.
I'm sorry. We had a bad connection there for just mm-hmm. a second. What was the last thing you mentioned?
The public on the outside doesn't notice because they turn on the radio. They hear pristine sound. It's in stereo. It sounds good. The processing is good, you know. But how we got there sometimes is a backstory in itself.
Yeah. Well, that's part of the magic of the radio. It's sound and. You know, there's an art to making beautiful sound, and it doesn't. You know, right now I'm remote at my stations in Greenville, Mississippi, and I'm in a messy, junked up room right now. But you don't know that because I turned the camera to look at our Rivendell automation systems right now. That we'll move into the racks as soon as we get the racks moved over here. Mm-hmm. I've got four radio stations running behind me
right here on
these little Dell machines. Mm-hmm. So do you want to move the conversation into the transition you just made in your life?
Well, 5.5 years at WBGO, talking transmitters. I built a transmitter project for them that was a lot of fun. They they used to actually broadcast from a flagpole in downtown Newark.
Okay.
And I mean that in all the literal sense.
Okay.
They had they were an HD station that did space combining. So there were two ERI antennas mounted on a flagpole in mm-hmm. downtown Newark at 400 feet. And the flag was waving at the top.
Wow.
So you had two ERI rototillers on this flagpole, and that was their HD setup. They did space combining. Wow. WBGO was always one of those jazz stations that played good music, but in parts of the city where their core audience was, you just couldn't hear them. New York City, I'm talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
So one of the things that I did when I first got there was they handed me the plans for a possible move to New York City, and they said, "What do you think about it?" Well, I looked at the plans, retweaked it, reworked it a little bit, ended up moving the station to 4 Times Square. And now they're broadcasting from 4 Times Square. They've got the penetration into New York City that they want. They are reaching thousands more listeners than they had been before. The signal's pretty good. It's a directional signal, unfortunately. So we have some coverage that we lost to the east of us to protect another 88.3. But overall, it was a good project. And one of the things that was fun about it was that it was a digital project in that 80% of the equipment in the transmitter room are all IP-based, meaning that I could, from my laptop, the same computers that I use in my house, I can control the radio station. I can go into the transmitter. I can switch the transmitters off and on. We use the Nortel transmitters, which are very friendly when it comes to controlling them by a computer, mm-hmm. and all solid-state transmitters. And again, it was a really fun project to set up. I learned a lot from it, and some of what I learned on that project and what I've learned over the years about IP audio was attractive to a job that I just took recently with Westwood One. Westwood One built a facility in Purchase, New York, which is 20 minutes from my house, actually. And Through a friend, I found out that they were looking for a broadcast IT person, and I threw my hat in the ring, and they gave me the nod, and I started last week as their director of broadcast IT. And what's nice about it is it's an Axia facility. The job is very computer based. There's not a microphone in the place, not a console or a microphone.
Yeah, place. You don't create content there. You distribute content.
We distribute content, exactly. Yeah. And one of my roles is to help maintain the systems that are involved in distributing that content. And that's the Axia audio nodes, and that's the servers that all the audio is residing on.
You know, actually, that's one location, a major AOIP, audio over IP installation, that I haven't been to yet. I've been promising that Gary Klein and others, I want to come visit. And it just hasn't worked out yet. And maybe I'll get to go there just prior to when I come up for the SBE meeting in Verona, New York.
At the
SBE
in September
there.
Yeah.
Maybe I can fly into New York and visit you guys and purchase and then head on over to the meeting. I'd love to do that. But working for Telos and Axia and Omnia, I was involved in a lot of meetings about setting that place up and getting everything going. One thing I found interesting, I thought you'd like to know this. You know, there's still engineers who speculate about, can you send reliably audio over the public internet or even over WANs, you know? And so just as an experiment, one of the support techs at Telos Omnia Axia is Brian Jones. Used to work at BE. And so just for fun, Brian set up a stream going from one of the iPorts that's at that facility you work at now. Mm-hmm. And he streamed from an iPort across the public internet. Now, they got great connectivity there. But he's across the public internet out to Brian Jones' house in Washington State, where he received it on an iPort that he has. And then he re-encoded it and sent it to an iPort at my office in Nashville, Tennessee.
Okay.
Now, I've just got Comcast home internet. I pay for a speed bump. But so he was feeding me this CBS Radio Sports Network. So I had my own personal feed of the CBS Radio Sports Network for, I guess we kept it going for 4 months.
Okay.
And I never heard it burp. I never heard it go out at all. And I'm not a big sports fan, but every time I tune it right in, yep, there it is. It's working fine. Sounds great. And so it impressed upon me that, of course, if your IP connection goes away, then you got no audio. If thunderstorm covers up your KU band dish, you got no audio. There's lots of ways to stop audio, no matter what your methodology is. Enough birds land on your 950 megahertz microwave dish, and you got no audio.
Right, right.
Yeah. So
snow.
So anyway, I keep showing myself that this audio over IP, it's not only is it here, but it's going to be.
It works.
It works, and as our connections get better, as companies offer more and more ways to connect to each other. Hey, I'm working with a station group right now that has a dozen O&O affiliates, and they've got MPLS IP connectivity to all of them. And they're deciding right now between a product that the company that I work for and a different product, they're deciding right now, we're going to do an AOIP. No question about that. It's just which company are we going to – whose codecs are we going to use?
Absolutely. Yeah. These days, I don't think it's a question of if you should. It's just a matter of when should you, or which company or which infrastructure are you going to go with to make it happen. To me, there's no other way to do it. Especially, with the maturity of the technology these days, I don't see any reason not to go that route. you find more often than not, it's cheaper to maintain. It's cheaper, definitely cheaper to install. I work with a little college station up in North Jersey at Ramapo College, and I got them to spend about $20,000 and refit their main air studio with Axia, and they're now audio over IP.
There's
no reason why you can't go from the microphone to the transmitter with audio over IP connections these days.
So I've maintained, David, that one of AOIP's biggest impediments, the biggest things to more rollout and success, is engineers like me who don't know everything. I don't have a formal education in computer networking, but mm-hmm. I've found out all the ways, like Edison, I found out all the ways it doesn't work. So that, I'm finding out the ways that it does work. I have a keen interest in it, obviously. But here's my point. There's plenty of engineers out there who honestly feel like, I don't know how to make it work. I don't, I've had too many times when the salesperson presses the print button on their proposal and the printer doesn't work. And therefore, how can my audio be reliable? Now, I'm not intending for this show to go entirely off in that direction, but I guess my point is that, but there's so many things out of your control there. When you understand how to make the packets work for you, then they really can, and they really do. Tell me how you got to be confident in this technology in your own heart, for your own self.
I guess the best way that I got confident in it was my first experience with Audio VIP was to replace an aging an aging ITC router, audio router.
I remember those. Yeah.
Yeah.
You had one?
At WQXR, myself.
I saw that one. Yes.
Yes. Yeah, so with me and Rodney Bellazier.
Rodney, when Rodney bypassed a lot of that with some Axia. Axia gear.
That was my first exposure to Axia and to audio over IP. And my first exposure to it just made sense, to push the audio over a Cat 5 cable. Steve Lampkin from Belden.
Oh, sure.
Well, I'd heard numerous presentations by him, just touting that the cable can support the audio and the technology. And my comfort level was listening to him and having him really convince us as engineers in these presentations that you don't need a lot of multi-pair cable to push audio these days, that the technology is in place that will support pushing audio packets over a Cat 5 cable. And at QXR, when we replaced the routing system and it worked, it was like, wow, this was really simple. The hardest part of making it work was running the cable through the ceilings and the floors.
That was
the hardest part.
Yes.
But as we went along, we started figuring out ways to solve problems and solutions using the nodes. And mind you, we didn't have any consoles. All we had was nodes to replace a routing system. We were routing audio in and out of our plant using the nodes. We came up with so many creative ways to solve problems, even existing problems, that we said, okay, we need a simplified way of doing this. Heck, we stuck one in our phone room. We stuck one node in each studio and made it all talk to a Cisco switch. Guess what? We had now connectivity, and that's about as hard as it was. And my comfort level just came from the fact that it was reliable and it worked. It sounded good. We never had a complaint from any of the announcers or the listeners about the audio coming out of our studios. In fact, WQXR back in that time was known for having pristine audio.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So the comfort level really just came from the ease of use, really. And I don't know how to put it any other way. Now, as far as reliability of it, again, I've had to reboot a computer more times than I've ever had to restart an audio node or any audio over IP devices themselves.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Sure. Most of them are made with Linux embedded as the operating system, and certainly the devices have been going for 7-8 years.
Yes.
Only time they get rebooted is if the power goes off, and if you got a UPS, then the power may never go off.
Right.
Wow. Rodney, this has been really enjoyable talking to you. I'm sure we've missed something important, some important subject to you. Is there anything you want to make sure we get to talk about before we close it out?
Well, I guess the only other thing is, I don't know how many young people might be viewing this broadcast, but even if there aren't any out there, you know, you guys that are older, find some young person and mentor them. If you're a young person, find a guy in the studio like Kirk, who's got three stations down in Mississippi and needs some help. Just go in there. I'm sure he'd love to see you walk in the door. Mm-hmm. If you don't do that, find a local chapter of the SBE. They generally have meetings once a month. They're free, and they'll be happy to see you walk in the door.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, if you're in school and you're interested in broadcasting, learn the sciences that support and complement broadcasting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you look at me, you look at Kirk. I'm going bald. Kirk's going gray. You know, we're not getting any younger, but we need some young blood, some new blood in this industry to keep it going. Radio is not dead, in spite of what others might say. And you know, it is a fun technology, and you know, you can get a lot of satisfaction and enjoyment out of it.
And you know, David, I'm convinced that even as other media whittle away very slowly at what has been traditional radio, we're still going to have content creators, no matter what the transmission medium is. Hey, in 15 years, if AM and FM is not even in your car anymore, if it's all streaming, mobile streaming by, you know, 6G technology, whatever it may be, somebody's got to make that content. A lot of folks don't want to just listen to a jukebox. They want to be talked to. I mean, the John Teshes of the world and the Delilahs of the world, and then all the talk and the NPR kind of news and the in-depth stuff. You know, you want to be entertained, and listening to a jukebox, like an iPod, that's you know, there's a place for that, but it sure isn't everything.
That sure is it. Plus, look, you and I are talking on microphones. We're listening to speakers. We have headphones. We have a console. There's still those support pieces of gear that are going to be involved in creating that content. Somebody needs to know how to manipulate it and to make it work and to put it all together as a system and make it produce just what we're doing right now.
Hey, you know, there's people doing content like Tom Likas. You know, used to be on the radio. Mm-hmm. Now he's all on the web, but he's got a fantastic studio. He's even got a Telos VX phone system to take phone callers from people. I guess we can yell at him, you know, for a web-based stream. So yeah, content, mm-hmm. content. It's going to be there.
Yes.
Don't get stuck don't be the last expert in the world on AM directionals, although I guess we'll need the last expert in the world on that. But someday, you know, we probably won't have that, or at least not like we know it now.
Yeah.
David, thank you so much for your time. This has been just a delight, and I'm glad you're able to make the time to talk to us on This Week in Radio Tech.
Oh, glad to do it. It's been long overdue, and I've enjoyed it. And, you know, hopefully we do it again sometime on another subject.
Sure, glad that David Antoine was able to talk to us last night and do that interview for us on This Week in Radio Tech. And you're watching episode 226 of This Week in Radio Tech. Kirk Harnack here, along with Chris Tobin. And Chris and I are going to continue a conversation. Hey, Chris, continue a conversation and take a tour of what's on Chris Tobin's desk. Chris, are you going to be ready to give us a tour after the next sponsor break?
Sure, why not?
All right. I want to see what's there, item by item, in excruciating detail. Hey, our show is brought to you in part by our friends at Lavo. Lavo, makers of the crystal clear virtual radio console. This is an incredible idea. We had Mike Dosh with Lavo on our show some weeks back. If you want to go back and watch that show, you can. The crystal clear is a virtual mixing console for radio. And by virtual, what I mean is you have a multi-touch touchscreen in front of you that looks like an audio console, except it does so much. And then it's connected just by Ethernet, just on the network, to a mixing engine that has all the audio ins and outs and then all the guts that run, the virtual mixing console. It's a gorgeous device. The surface, what you see on the screen is absolutely beautiful. It's unmistakably an audio mixing console for broadcast. And one of the things that I guess really separates a console like this from a hardware console is that it has fewer buttons and yet more control. Software control is much more flexible than hardware buttons and knobs found on traditional consoles and control surfaces. For example, assigning a DJ microphone to a fader on Crystal Clear changes the button above the fader from Q to mute. So it was a Q button, now becomes a mute button. So it's context sensitive. And this applies to so many attributes of the Crystal Clear console from Lavo. It has a smart auto mix and auto gain. So let's say that you change a microphone here or there, or you have a guest who's particularly loud, or a guest who is shy of the microphone. Before you start interviewing that guest, you just push the auto gain button and you have the guest say a few words, and the gain is set automatically for that guest and that microphone. Auto mix also lets you set the way the mix sounds so that you don't have to sit there and ride gain with the faders all the time. The mix can intelligently take care of itself. Of course, the Crystal Clear console is available with Ravenna, audio over IP, so it's compatible with a whole range of other devices, and that includes AES-67, the new AES-67 standard for audio over IP, and all the manufacturers are getting in that direction to make those devices all talk to each other. So check it out on the web, if you would. Go to lavo.com. Now, that's spelled L-A-W-O, like Lawo, but it's pronounced Lavo. Go to lavo.com and look under the products. Look under the radio products. You'll see other consoles as well there. You know, Lavo makes some great, big, huge consoles for television, for live sound, and they were really into the technology of building consoles. But they also have a range of radio consoles. So the Crystal Clear virtual radio mixing console from Lavo. We thank Lavo for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. All right, Chris Tobin, glad you're here, and you get this beautiful lab there with all these IP audio products. You know, there's something to this IP audio, isn't there?
Yeah, there is something to it. It does work, as Dave pointed out. I have to remind everyone, and you know this, Kirk, and the others that you work with, we have been so spoiled by the performance of TDM switched networks that we've forgotten that the phone company or the phone carrier, depending where who you get your provisions from, ISDN, POTS, T1, E1, ATM, Sonnet Rings, all these things, they were managed from point A to point B, or in the case of broadcast, from studio to transmit. Everything in the middle was taken care of by a third party. Fast forward to today, and what's behind me, what you have at your place, are IP devices. IP now puts the onus, the responsibility, the accountability on you. You now have to manage those spots in between studio and transmitter.
That's a great way to say it.
And that's what makes it so powerful if you really are into it. Now, if you're an old dog and you've decided not to learn new tricks, God bless you, take your retirement and be on your way. That's cool. Or you're an old dog who likes new tricks and sits down and reads the book and says, wait a minute, I can do this, this, and this. And I say this only because I recently spoke with someone yesterday in a part of the country who is an old dog learning new tricks, and has taken advantage of IP and TDM in one package and figured out how to make it work for his operation. And he'll be uplinking his audio in about 3 days to satellite for distribution to a small radio network. Mm-hmm. So he's future-proofed himself with codecs on the IP side of things. He's maintained his TDM network connection for the time being while he still gets it at a cheap rate so that he can exploit the IP when the time comes to just move over to MPLS or Metro Ethernet, whatever you want to call it. So just a point of, you know, that's what we're looking at behind me is this technology that I'm working with folks and helping them out as we spoke.
You know, you're so right. And I've tried to say it other ways, but you just really said it well. And that is that we used to buy ISDN and T1 type connections, things that were managed by somebody else. And
there you go.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
Adtran 2x64. That's a staple of the industry. We all know it. Right?
Yep.
And you don't know it, that means you've been around too short a time.
Or you live in small town America where the services that connected that weren't even available.
Okay, yes, we can go that route too.
Happened to me. I tended to work in small markets. But what you said about now with IP, well, here, let me back up a second to hit what you said. You know, a T1 circuit 40 years ago was 1.5 some megabits per second. It's still the same today. It hasn't gotten any better. It may be more or less expensive now than it was 40 years ago. ISDN is you bond two B channels together, and you'll probably get 128 kilobits per second in total. And it's the same now as it was 20 years ago. And it costs more, and it doesn't do any more. So we had 20 years go by, and it doesn't do any more. And you know what? audio compressed to 128 kilobits per second is okay, but what if we want to do better than that? Well, IP can do better, but now you got to manage it. You got to make sure that it's right at each end. And yeah, there's a certain amount of trust in the part in the middle, but there are some things you can do to mitigate that part too. I'm sorry, I stole your thunder, but I really appreciate the way that you said that. You, Mr. Engineer, have got to learn how to manage that part that you didn't used to have to manage.
Yes, that's basically it. I mean, and the nice thing is there are many products like the Zip codec that gives you the tools that you need to make that work. And many other products do the same thing. There are many management tools you can get for a LAN, WAN, Metro Ethernet connection so you can monitor the traffic. You know, as you were talking with Dave Antoine about the various things that were going on and how stuff is going with IP, you manage your network in the office for your automation systems. You have Cisco switches, or maybe you have Nortel or HP. You have tools to check that. There are tools, the same tools can check your IP audio, IP video. And that's what's cool about it. But, you know, it takes time. You just and also, don't be fooled by the marketing, remember, because we all remember back in the day, we can get ISDN anywhere. Here you go. It's real cheap. It's easy. And then you go to connect, and you're like, it's not working. I don't know what to tell you. Same thing happens with IP. I get you this great DSL. You'll get 3 meg down and 1.5 meg up. You're all great to go. Yeah, they don't manage it very well, and there's a lot of jitter and a lot of latency, and you're saying, well, what's going on? But today you have tools that you can actually test it and check it and go back to the phone company and say, guys, you know, come step up to the plate. You didn't do it right for me.
You know, one of the things that does come to mind to me is that if you ordered ISDN and you got to the ballpark or wherever it was, the Ford dealer, and you hooked up to it and it didn't work, you had but one option. Call the only people in town who could provide it, who could fix it. And, you know, in many markets that actually worked out okay. The phone company was on top of things. But in many other markets, they had, like here in Greenville, Mississippi, we had ISDN at a studio here 10, 12, 13, 14 years ago. But if something went wrong with it and they couldn't fix it remotely with, you know, their computer technology, they had to roll a truck from Jackson, Mississippi, a 2.5 hour drive to send an ISDN tech here. Now, now that we're in the world of IP, in most places, you got more than one choice for your IP. So, well, for example, last week we did the show from Universal Studios in Orlando, and Bob Page made arrangements for a high-speed connection from Universal, from the IT department there, and it worked when we tested it, and then it didn't work when we actually went to use it to do the show. And that was disappointing, and it couldn't be fixed right away. It's probably fixed now, but it was like 70 megs up and down. It was wonderful. That didn't work, so we had to back him and punt. And guess what? We tried the Xfinity Wi-Fi that was on site, the AT&T Wi-Fi, and then some other park Wi-Fi for Orlando's theme park. And it turned out we used the park Wi-Fi, and you know the show was a little blocky looking. It wasn't perfect, but we got the show on the air. And if we were depending upon ISDN or a T1, we wouldn't have had a show at all. We would have no option.
This is true, and I can tell you it's now 4 years ago. I was doing a remote broadcast, and our ISDN services were not working properly. I did have a backup. Thankfully, it was a very helpful tech manager for a TV network. And it called the phone company and said, guys, for whatever reason, the ISDNs were working just fine. Literally last night, everything was good. We had codecs dialed up and tested. And this morning, here we are, 3 hours from broadcast, and all of a sudden, nothing. Literally, no voltage, nothing. It was just dead. There was nothing there. No clicking from the clock, the sync pulse. And the lady on the phone at the service desk said, well, it's a holiday weekend. We don't have anybody available. I was like, well, this is a enterprise account. I said, you should have somebody available for enterprise accounts. Needless to say, after 2 hours of calling every number we had, nothing could be done. This was July 4th in New York City. Carrier was Verizon. It's the new world we're in. So thankfully, I was working with the NBC Television Network folks, and my buddy is the tech manager there, and we got our audio on the fourth channel audio of their digital satellite uplink back to 30 Rock, and there we had ISDN dial back to our studios downtown, and broadcast went according to plan that evening. Granted, it was a very large link between the studio and remote, but 25,000 miles, what the heck, you know?
Woo, took a little...
You always have a plan B, but this is where we are today with IP. You now have, as you pointed out, many choices. I last week was on the New Jersey shore. You were in Orlando, Florida. I had a cable modem connection. My backup was my Verizon USB LTE modem stick, which I've tested, and it does work very well. So mm-hmm. I had two choices. If I relied only on ISDN at that location, if that's all I had, the only next best thing would have been POTS, maybe. You know, if the ISDN went out because of a wiring issue, most likely the POTS went with it. Because why? They travel the same path.
Something
to consider.
Yeah. You know, you travel around some. I do, too. One of the things about IP connectivity, and with all those IP codecs behind you there, you know this, and I know you you probably advise your clients of this. Have more than one way to get IP. And one way to do that is to carry something as simple as a smartphone with a data sharing plan or a cradle point modem or something like that, a travel modem or a travel router, as they're often called, and have a Verizon or AT&T or T-Mobile USB data stick that you can plug in there. At the hotel I'm staying at right now, the internet's really slow. If I want some faster internet, I tried it, works great. I got a cradle point with a Verizon 4G modem, and I was getting 32 megs down and 18 megs up. That's better than the wired service I have right here in this building. But the interesting thing is, for some reason, in the downtown area, Verizon's 4G LTE doesn't work very well, but T-Mobile's does. This tells you, when you go out to do a broadcast, a remote, you got to have a couple of backup plans to get your IP there.
It's true. I travel with a cradle point as well. That's exactly what I do. It's a nice backup. It works very well.
So, real quick, this, you've got a Comrex Access there, the portable unit.
Yes, they do.
Yep, that is one of the big industry standards. Folks love to use that. Take different USB cards, right, plus Wi-Fi or wired.
Yes, this is a first generation, so it's a PCMCIA card slot. And also, USB. I can do both on this one. The newer version has the USBs on the top.
Yeah. What's the purple-looking box that's right behind you there, underneath the zip?
That is a Rode Warrior Musicam Portable Mixer IP ISDN codec. Second generation. The new ones are actually black in color.
It's one of the few boxes that had both ISDN and IP, which is technically a bit of an unusual combination because they are very, very different in their implementation.
Yes, it was designed to bridge the gap for folks who already had ISDN infrastructure that they weren't looking to get rid of but were willing to make as a backup so they didn't have to pay the per unit costs. And then with the IP, that was their main link. And it also, box would allow you to go IP failure, switch back to ISDN. So there's your plan B. That was your plan B.
And then you've got a TeleZip 1, which will do wired or Wi-Fi, or hook it to a cradle point travel router, and you've got 4G.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Cool.
And then I have some legacy ISDN boxes, an X21 generator and stuff, and things like that for testing. And then there's also the AES boxes, so we can check those things. For those Monty Python listeners.
We're going to take a quick break, have a final comment when we come back. Chris, hang tight. Our show is brought to you in part by Telos and the Telos HX6 phone system. I got one here at the studios here in Greenville, just down the hall. I was giving a little training session showing folks how to use it today. The Telos HX6, I got to tell you, folks, this is an awesome little phone system. Six lines. And, of course, you can divide them up into hunt groups or set aside a separate line. You can make one of them or more of them a hotline, have it flash a ringer differently than the others. It has, of course, XLR connectors on the back for mix minus going in and caller audio coming out. It has the ability to create its own mix minus or its own conferencing signal, I should say. You feed it a mix minus, just one mix minus, that's devoid of either caller, either hybrid, and it will take your mix minus, mix it with the other hybrid, like hybrid A, and feed it to hybrid B. And then it'll do the same thing. Take the mix minus, combine it with hybrid B, and feed it to hybrid A. The bottom line is, callers can hear each other, even if you have a console that is only capable of making one mix minus. Now, if you have an Axia console, it's no problem. It makes mix minus for every single input coming in. The HX6 will take six POTS lines coming into it, worldwide standards there. For the USA and Canada, it will take ISDN lines as well, three ISDN BRI channels coming in, gives you six phone lines for US and Canada. The hybrids inside are really Telos's fifth generation of telephone hybrids. Really great separation of send and receive audio. It has a longer tail, if you will, to do proper nulling for connections that have a longer round trip time, such as cell phones and VoIP phones. So if you're talking to somebody out in the world who's calling you using Skype out, or they're calling you on some other, you know, VoIP-based phone, it's got a little more delay in it from end to end. Well, older hybrids don't have a long enough tail on their nulling period. Well, the Telos HX6 certainly does, just like the HX1 and the HX2. So works great from all those points of view. Hey, we're going to be using it here. We're going to be turning VoIP into six POTS lines using a little Grandstream box that turns VoIP into POTS. And so that'll be a great solution. Costs will go down to almost nothing. I think we're going to end up paying less than $20 a month for four phone lines. That's a great relief for a little radio station. And we'll have request lines for all of our stations here, and also a hotline. So it's just a terrific solution. The other cool thing about the HX6 is that it does have a live wire jack on it. Now, you can turn live wire off, and that's how it comes default. Hook it to your regular business network and hook up your controlling phones, the Telos VSET phones. Just hook them up to your network. Tell them what the IP address is of the HX6, and bam, they're connected. Your shows show up, the phone lines show up, they're named, convenient names, you know, WIQQ line, request line, WLTM request line, those are the ones I've got set up here, the hotline, WNIX Talk 1, WNIX Talk 2 have some rollover lines. It all connects over your business network, over your Ethernet network, and it works just great. If you do have actually a LiveWire set up, as we do here, then you can just turn LiveWire on and get phones and audio over one connection in the back. I got to tell you, folks, it is so convenient to hook it up. I mean, the toughest part was punching down the POTS lines that I had to wire in, the legacy POTS lines we have to wire in the back of it. The rest of it was just RJ45 and a little bit of typing. Check it out if you would on the web. Any Telos dealer can give you information about the Telos HX6. And, of course, you can get information on the web as well. And there's a video I did a few months ago about the Telos HX6 and some great ideas for hooking it up and saving money. So check it out at telos-systems.com. I'd be really grateful if you did. And you're going to do yourself a favor. Love that box. All right. Chris Tobin, we're about out of time, buddy. Any last parting comments on engineering career or your IP audio technology?
I would just say, as far as careers go, if you have a passion for what we do, go after it. Learn what you can. Understand there are reasons why things are done a certain way in the business we're in. And once you grasp that perspective, you're in good shape, as Dave pointed out in the conversation you had with him earlier. So that's all I can offer up. And if you're a student and you're looking to do something and you have a hankering for this kind of thing, find someone, an elder, who's been around for a while and see if you can get involved and learn a little from that so you have an opportunity to make a decision. An SBE is definitely a choice you should make to find out more. SBE meetings, that is.
That's very true. You'll find some good Elmers from the ham world at SBE meetings, and good camaraderie and professional education too. Hey, we got to go. Chris, I hope on an upcoming show you can give us a longer tour and maybe some how-tos of some things that you do in the lab there. How to make this codec talk to that one. Or, hey, I'm not getting the audio. What should I look for? That kind of thing.
Okay, I can do that. I'm working on a how-to for a customer for two different dissimilar codecs.
Yeah, there you go. I do that too. What to do when your audio sounds like that? What do you look for? That kind of thing. Yeah, yeah. Because it does happen from time to time. But once you get it figured out, goes away. Problem goes away, not the audio. Hey, our show's been brought to you by the folks at Axia, makers of the Axia Radius console. Also by Lavo, makers of the Crystal Clear virtual radio console. And by Telos and the Telos HX6 multi-line phone system. Our producer is Andrew Zarian, proprietor, owner, founder of the GFQ Network. I encourage you to check out all the shows on GFQ at gfqnetwork.com or gfqlive.tv. And that's it, folks. We got some great shows coming up for you. Very interesting guests in future weeks. And we'll see you next time on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye, everybody.